Do right and wrong change with time or with culture? Let's talk about it. A man checked into a hospital to have really routine surgery, but the man was a really mean person. I mean, he was ugly to everyone. He was ugly to his family, to his friends, to the hospital staff, to the nurses, and to his own doctors. As my grandmother would say, he was just downright ornery. And people avoided him like the plague. Well, he had his surgery, and he did just fine. But as he was coming out of his surgery, waking up, he noticed that the blinds on his window in his room had been closed, and he didn't want them closed. So he rang for a nurse. And in came running this Fried Hardeman nursing student with a smile on her face, and she said, "Yes, sir, how may I help you?" And he barked at her. He said, "Who authorized you to close the blinds on my window? I don't want those blinds closed. If I had wanted those blinds closed, I would have told you. I want those blinds open, and I want them to stay open, and if I want them closed, I'll tell you. Do you understand?" I mean, he was mean. He was just ugly to people. Well, with a smile, she responded by saying, "Well, next door to the hospital is a vacant lot. They're doing some construction work next door, and they're burning some trash, and the fire's pretty big. We didn't want you to wake up from your surgery, look out that window, see that fire, and think for some reason the surgery had failed." That was her way of saying, "You're a mean man. You're not a very nice person at all." The truth is, see, she had a moral compass. She knew the difference between right and wrong. Somewhere along the way, he had lost his, if he ever really had one. And obviously, he didn't really know the difference between right and wrong, the right way to treat people, as opposed to the wrong way to treat them. One has to wonder about America, what's happened to our moral compass. You've thought about it, I know, as I have. We don't call it fornication anymore. We call it living together. It's no longer adultery, it's just an affair. It's no longer homosexuality, it's an alternate lifestyle. It's not as easy as God made them male and female. Today, it's my gender identity or my pronouns. We don't talk in terms of lying or liars. People talk about, "I just misspoke." We don't think about embezzlement or political corruption or any other kind of corruption in those ways. We just simply hear the spin, "Mistakes were made." And even with doctrinal subjects that are so fundamental in the Bible, they have now been rationalized to the point that as they're changed, they're simply justified this way, like baptism or instrumental music or the role of women. The changes or compromise made to those doctrines, people rationalize by just simply saying, "Well, that's how they did it in that time. That's the way they did it in that culture, but that doesn't mean that's the way we have to do it today, and certainly our culture is different, our culture has changed, and well, that's the way they used to do it, but that's not the way we have to do it now." The truth is, right and wrong are right and wrong. They've always been right and wrong. The problem is we live in a postmodern society, in a postmodern world. Basically, postmodernists believe there are no absolutes, which, by the way, is an absolute. And to them, truth is simply relative. And so what I believe, and perhaps more importantly, the way I feel, that's my truth. And what you believe and the way you feel, well, that's your truth. And I have no right to judge you, and you have no right to judge me. You're right, I'm right, we're all right. And not everyone, of course, can be right. And we understand that in these doctrinal discussions, culture plays a big role. But right and wrong are absolutes. They are universal truths. They are not relative to the times or relative simply to the cultures. They are eternal. To prove that or illustrate that, I'd like to use this passage from Matthew 19, 1 through 10. Now, typically when we read this passage, we're talking about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Let me tell you up front, this is not meant to be an in-depth study of marriage, divorce, and remarriage. I simply have chosen this passage because it's convenient. Because in this one passage, I can show you four different times, four different cultures, or four different worlds, and prove to you that right and wrong never changed. That right and wrong were always right and wrong, no matter the time, no matter the culture. As a matter of fact, when I approach Matthew 19, 1 through 10, and in premarital counseling, and I did this with Matthew and Claire, I have them read Matthew 19 in their own Bibles quietly to themselves. And so at least once they've read those passages. Now, they've read them before, but I want them to read them not to intimidate them, not to put fear into them, but to illustrate to them the sanctity of marriage, the holiness of marriage, the importance of marriage to God. And so I choose to look at this passage in a rather positive note. So this isn't intended to be an in-depth study of marriage, divorce, and remarriage. I simply want to illustrate to us this evening and remind us this evening that right and wrong don't change with times or with culture. So let me share with you four different worlds from this passage. First of all, think with me about the world or the times or the culture of the Jews when Jesus walked on this earth. And a pretty fair picture of what that society might have looked like can be found in the first three verses of Matthew 19. So look with me. Now it came to pass when Jesus had finished these sayings that he departed from Galilee and came to the region of Judea beyond the Jordan. And great multitudes followed him and he healed them there. The Pharisees also came to him, testing him and saying to him, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason?" First of all, in this passage, we must realize that the Pharisees are disingenuous with their question. They're not really sincere. They're not really looking for an honest answer or the truth. Many of them have already rejected Jesus. What they're trying to do is to trap Jesus, to entangle Jesus in his speech, to discredit him, to put him in what they thought would be an impossible bind, so that whatever answer he gave, it would be wrong and would bring great problems to his ministry. So that's the first thing we need to understand. But the second thing we need to understand is the world that Jesus found when he entered this world. And that world, during the time of the Pharisees, at this time, with this question, can a man divorce his wife for any reason or just any reason, there were debates that went on or were going on regarding the answer to that question. For example, there was Rabbi Hillel and the rabbinical school of Hillel. They believed that a man could divorce his wife for any reason and marry someone else, anyone else he chose to marry. At the other end was Rabbi Shammai. And the rabbinical school of Shammai taught that a man could divorce his wife only for the reason of uncleanness. If he had found some uncleanness in her, then he could divorce her. Now, what the Pharisees are trying to do, they're trying to put Jesus in the very middle of this debate, and they're trying to find out, well, with which preacher will Jesus side? Where will he come down in answer to this question? Ironically, both Hillel and Shammai, the rabbinical schools, reach their conclusions from the same passage in the Bible, Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4. Now, since we've not read Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4 in the last few days, Let's flip back over there. Keep your finger in Matthew 19. We are coming back, I promise. But let's read Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4. And let's just listen to what Moses had to say to the children of Israel. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that he finds no favor in his, she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her. Now I'm reading from the New King James Version. And he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house. When she has departed from his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, if the latter husband detests her and writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies who took her as his wife. You almost need a scorecard, don't you? It's a little mind-boggling, a little confusing when you read it. Verse 4, then her former husband who divorced her must not take her back to be his wife after she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. Well, Hillel interpreted this passage to mean that a man could divorce his wife for any reason. I mean, any reason. If she displeased him in any way, for any cause, he could divorce her and marry anyone else that he wanted to marry. Shammai, on the other hand, took this verse and looked at it and said there had to have been some uncleanness in her for him to follow through with the divorce. Now, uncleanness is not a word that truly resonates with us, but in the New American Standard Version, the word is translated indecency. And the idea, and it's also in the revised, the English Standard Version as well, some indecency. So the idea is some immodesty or something that's inappropriate or perhaps even something that is shameful. Well, for that, he could give her a writing of divorce and put her away. Now, we need to understand something about this certificate of divorce. Really, what we're talking about is a document of divorce. It's something that, number one, is official. Number two, it had to be public. Papers had to be served. A man couldn't just announce, my wife has been unclean, or my wife has done this, or my wife has done that, and so I'm going to divorce her. I'm going to send her away. He couldn't do that. And then notice, number three, it wasn't just for any reason. The reason is given here implicitly or explicitly. And that is some indecency in her, or some inappropriateness in her, or perhaps some immodesty in her. And then there's something else about this passage that we need to understand as well. Once he has divorced her, he cannot take her back. Even if he wanted to have her back, he could not remarry her. And that is different than what we read in the New Testament. But what Moses is trying to do here, what God is trying to do here through Moses, is to prevent them from just simply possessing disposable marriages. They couldn't just divorce their wives for any reason and then just marry someone else. They just would rather be with someone else for whatever the reason was. And so when Jesus is asked this question, can a man divorce his wife for just any reason? That's a loaded question. So which preacher will he side with? Well, he'll side with neither, of course. But you see, this is the bind they think they have Jesus in. And that bind is, if he sides with Hillel, then he's too liberal. If he sides with Shammai, he's too conservative. Too legalistic, too narrow-minded. They thought they had him in a situation where he could not win. But Jesus doesn't side with either rabbinical school. He sides with God. And he sides with God's word. So look at the second world or the second culture or time that's mentioned here in verses 4 through 6. And that is the world of Adam. And he answered and said to them, have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female? and said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate. And so Jesus goes back to where? The beginning. Look at verse 4 again. In the beginning. He goes back to when God created marriage. In Genesis 2, verse 24. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife, and they shall become one flesh. So Jesus sides neither with Hillel or Shammai. He sides with what his father created, what his father had always taught, and the way marriage was always intended to be. One man for one woman for life. And that answered their question. And he answered it from Scripture. But notice Jesus' amazement at the Pharisees, who were supposedly the most learned of the Jews in the Scriptures. The word Pharisee literally means strict. They were strict adherents to the law of Moses, strict observers of the law of Moses. And yet they didn't know this. Or they had forgotten this, or they didn't understand this, that from the very beginning, God said marriage was to be holy and was to be sanctified and was precious in his eyes. So when we come to the world of the Jews, in which we find Jesus ministering, when Jesus is asked this question about marriage and about divorce and remarriage, Jesus declares what had always been said, what had been said from the beginning to that very moment. Right and wrong had not changed. They had not changed over time, nor had they changed with the cultures. The cultures are different. The Garden of Eden and Palestine in the days of Jesus, or Israel in the time of Jesus, they were different worlds, and yet still right and wrong were the same. They had never changed. They didn't change with the times, and they certainly didn't change with the cultures. So that's world two and one. Now look at number three, and that would be the world of Moses. If the world of Adam, or the time or culture of Adam, would be the patriarchal age, and I think justifiably so, we can understand it that way, then this would be the Mosaic dispensation, would it not? So when Jesus answers them this question that they posed to him, and he answers it through the Bible, and he answers it from the beginning, from the Garden of Eden, from the way God created marriage at the outset between man and woman, between Adam and Eve, they have one more trump card to play, if you will. One more card up their sleeves to play. Their ace in the hole, so to speak, Moses. They loved Moses. They loved the law of Moses. They cherished it so much so. They found great fault with Jesus because they believed Jesus came to destroy it. Of course, he didn't. He came to fulfill it, every jot, every tittle. But they bring up Moses in verse 7, taking us to a different time, the time of Moses. They said to him, why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? He said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives. Listen, but from the beginning, it was not so. What was not so? That a man could divorce his wife for any reason and marry someone else that he would rather be married to. That God had created marriage from the very beginning between one man and one woman for life. Right and wrong had not changed from the time of the Garden of Eden to the days of the law of Moses and even into the times when Jesus entered this world. And so Jesus, again, somewhat amazed at their ignorance of the Scriptures, corrects them, doesn't he? Did Moses ever command it? Moses did not, but Moses permitted it. And Jesus reminds them of this. And we have a parallel passage that helps to clarify this. In Matthew 3:15, when Jesus was baptized by John the Baptist. And he didn't want to do it. He didn't think he was worthy to do it. He would ultimately do it. Jesus convinced him to do it. You remember what Jesus said to him? It's the very same Greek word that's found here that they have misinterpreted as commandment. Jesus corrects them by saying, permit it to be so now, for thus it becometh us to fulfill all righteousness. So God permitted that document of divorce in the days of Moses, but Jesus gives the reason because of the hardness of men's hearts. Well, what in the world could that be? What do you think that is? What is it in the context that you could just divorce your wife for any reason and marry someone else? You could not do that. There had to be a reason. There had to be a cause. It had to be justified. It had to be served. It had to be executed. And you could not go back to her. You could not remarry her. So there was teeth in that law. Serious teeth in that law. But primarily, in even that passage, you could not divorce your wife for any reason. There had to be a legitimate reason. And that reason is given in Matthew 24. And that reason is given here in Matthew 19, verse 8. And so right and wrong hadn't changed, right? I mean, it was that way in the beginning, in the Garden of Eden. It was that way during the days of Moses. And it was certainly that way in the times in which Jesus ministered or walked this earth. And so Jesus upholds the truths of Genesis 24, or 2:24 rather. You know, I've heard people say this, and perhaps you have too. Well, David, I understand what you're saying about Matthew 19, verses 1 through 10. I'm with you. But was that not written to the Jews? I mean, doesn't that just apply to the Jews? I'm not a Jew. So, in other words, that doesn't apply to me. I mean, that was written to the Jews, right? How many Jews were around in the beginning? How many Jews were in the Garden of Eden? How many Israelites were in the Garden of Eden? They're not even called Hebrews yet. They're just Adam and Eve. They're just husband and wife. That's all they are. And I've heard people say to me in studying this passage, well, Brother David, that's just for Christians. That's the law for Christians. That's not the law for everyone. How many Christians were around in the Garden of Eden? The point is this. The truths are eternal. And the truths that are embedded here in this teaching of Jesus are simple. It is not hard to understand. It isn't too difficult to wrap around your head. It isn't rocket science. You don't have to go to Fried Hardeman to get it. Right and wrong don't change with time. Nor will they ever change. And they certainly don't change with cultures. God hasn't moved, but we have. And the only way to get back is to turn around and return to him. And that's why Jesus, in this passage, preached and taught something that was as unpopular then as it is now. Which of those two rabbinical schools do you think they prized? Which of those two rabbinical schools do you think was most popular? Well, it was Hillel, of course. Not Shammai. No one knew that better than Jesus. Well, finally, for us, there's the Christian age, correct? The patriarchal, the Mosaic, and the Christian age, the world of Jesus today. And that's in verses 9 and 10. And when Jesus says what he says in verse 9, this puts an exclamation point on the subjects of marriage, divorce, and remarriage. This is it. Here's what he says. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. And whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. And so when Jesus says that, that puts an end to all other laws. That does away with the patriarchal age. That removes the Mosaic dispensation. That leaves us with just this time and this Christian culture in which he is Lord of Lords and King of Kings. And you'll remember, Jesus had to deal with the traditions of men, and he had to deal with the teachings of men. And in Matthew 5, for example, in verse 27, he said, "But you have heard it said, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, that whosoever looks upon a woman to lust after her has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Jesus is saying, I know what you've been taught. I know what you've heard. But this is what I'm telling you, and this is now the law, the new law, the Christian law. And what had come before him had been done for all the right reasons. But men then, like men now, twist the scriptures to mean what they want them to mean. And one of their really clever arguments is that, well, that's the way it might have been back then, but that's not the way it has to be now. But if right and wrong don't change with time or over time or with cultures, that argument isn't sound. And that's what Jesus is reminding us of in this passage. So when Jesus got done teaching on the subject, let me show you how plain it was, how direct it was. Look at verse 10. Look at the disciples' response. His disciples said to him, "If such is the case of the man with his wife, it is better not to marry." Can you just imagine how much damage they had done to the sanctity of marriage in Jesus' time, that his own disciples said, then it is better we don't marry, because marriages apparently didn't last in those days. But that was not to be the norm anymore. This was to be the way to walk with Jesus in the sanctity and holiness of marriage. And so right and wrong don't change over time, and they don't change with culture. And so what do we do with this lesson? How does this lesson tie into us? And what difference does this lesson make to us? Go to the last slide. In 1996, John Skilonis was in Nashville, Tennessee. He was there for the National Baseball Coaches Association meeting. They were at the Opryland Hotel. There were over 4,000 people there. Skilonis was a college baseball coach for 43 years. Most of those years, he coached at Pepperdine University. He was 78 years old at that time, in 1996. He's since passed away. But Skilonis was the one speaker among all the other really powerful speakers they had in that conference that everybody wanted to hear. No one wanted to miss him because they respected him so much. And so as he shuffled his way to the podium, he had home plate. I mean, a major league home plate tied around his neck with a piece of string. And he's shuffling up to the podium and they're giving him a standing ovation. He hasn't even started yet. And when he gets up behind the podium and he begins to speak, he asks all the little league coaches in his audience, "How wide is home plate?" Well, no one really knew what to do or say because they were fixated on this home plate around the neck of this old man. A man that they respected and revered and loved, but they thought he had lost his mind. He said, "How wide is home plate?" Finally, someone meekly said, 17 inches. He said, "That's right, 17 inches. And then he said, "High school coaches, how wide is home plate?" And they said, 17 inches. He turned to the college coaches, "How wide is home plate?" And they bellowed it out, 17 inches. Minor league coaches, major league coaches, they were all there, 17 inches. He said, "That's right." And what do we do with a big league pitcher who cannot throw the baseball over a 17-inch home plate? We send him to the miners. He said, the one thing we don't do is say, that's okay. If you can't throw it over a 17-inch plate, we'll make it 17 and a half. Or if that's hard, we'll make it 18 inches. I tell you what, to make sure you can get it across, we'll make it 19 inches. And he turned to the coaches in his audience. And he said, coaches, let me ask you something. What do you do when your best player shows up late for practice? And he had gotten caught the night before drinking with his buddies. Will you play him? Will you bench him? Will you discipline him at all? What will you do with him? He said, this is the problem with our system, is that we aren't teaching our players accountability. And we're not holding them accountable to a standard, a clear standard of right and wrong. We are widening the plates, and we're not helping them at all when we do that. And then he took home plate and he turned it around. He got a Sharpie and he was drawing something, and no one knew what it was. When he turned it back around, he had drawn a house complete with windows and a door. And he said, let me tell you, this is what's wrong in our homes. We're not teaching our kids accountability. We're not teaching them right and wrong. And when they do wrong, we're not holding them accountable to that standard. We just simply widen the plate for them. And then he turned it around and he put a little flag on the top of it. He turned it back to his audience and he said, this is what's wrong with our government. Because there are those who are changing our constitution left and right, and we're not holding them accountable. They serve us. Yet they are changing the very basis of our government, and we're not calling them out. We're widening the plate. He turned the plate around again, replaced the flag with a cross, and said, this is what's wrong in the church. He said, we're not holding people accountable to God's word. We're not holding them accountable to his standard of right and wrong and what he has commanded. We have widened the plate. And then he said, what happens when we widen the plate in our homes, in our country, and in our churches, where the people who are supposed to serve us don't and aren't held accountable for it? What do we have to look forward to? He turned the plate back around. It's totally dark on the other side, right? The side that's on the dirt. He turned it around. It's stark black. And he says, we have dark days ahead of us. That was 1996. Was he right? Don't widen the plate. Right and wrong don't change with time or with culture. And I'll tell you one thing that we can be assured of, and that's this. God will never widen his plate. Amen. And God's standards and his plan of salvation and his demand for our discipleship and our faithfulness and our evangelizing a lost world, he will hold us accountable for that. He'll hold us accountable in our homes. He'll hold us accountable in our government. He'll hold us accountable in our schools. He'll hold us accountable in our churches. He's not going to widen the plate. And when we stand before him in the day of judgment, we can't expect him to just simply widen the plate for us and let us in. We have one choice, and that's to do what's right. And what is right tonight is to obey the gospel. And if you're here this evening and you've never obeyed the gospel, and you're living in sin, and you know it, you know you're wrong, Why not make it right? Do what's right. Obey the gospel tonight before it's too late. Or if you have obeyed the gospel, but you're not faithful to Jesus, you know you're wrong. You know that. People have talked to you, but they don't need to. In your conscience, in your heart of hearts, you know where you are. Why not change? The plate isn't going to be widened. The standard isn't going to change. Now is the day of salvation. Now is the time to respond. And if you're here this evening and ready to come, we're ready to receive you and help you while together we stand and sing.